So today is April 29th, and we're learning a Torah portion Saint Ever told us about. We've been in chapters 22, 23, and 24 of the Book of Numbers. Last time we did a certain type of overview of those chapters, talking about the relationship between most of the verses on the one hand to the 10 or so verses that talk about the talking donkey on the other hand, and that was good. I want to go back to the same, good evening, the same three chapters, and do another overview, but of a completely different subject within those chapters. And I have to admit that I'm doing this particular overview of this particular subject tonight. I'm inspired by Fred, who I assumed wouldn't be here. But we had a long conversation, he and I, after the last class, like half an hour, in which he told me what he gets out of the class, what he doesn't get out of it. And he told me he's looking for inspiration and big ideas. Of course, you can't really summarize a conversation in half an hour. So, inspired by that, I decided to do this class, and I wrote him an email 3 hours ago saying, Fred, this is just for you tonight. But I thought he might not come. But it's a good class anyway. So, the question is, look at the whole story of Balak and Bilam that we saw last time, that he's called on to curse the Jewish people, and he says, I can't do it. Can't do it. He's convinced. He goes, but he doesn't curse them. He blesses them, as we saw last time. What's the point of the whole story? What's it trying to teach us? That's what I want to focus on. And I'm not going to give one answer. I'm going to give two possible answers, perhaps there's more. Two answers that are not just different, but actually contradictory of what it's trying to teach us. In order to begin the discussion, I want to read. Yeah. I want to read. Some of the major verses that we saw last time, just to go over them. On the sheet, I wrote in A1 about 10 different sets of verses that might be understood to contain the main idea of the material. Do you have a Tanakh? You did?
Yes,
okay,
thank
great.
You.
Okay. So here we are in the book of Numbers, chapter 22. Verse 6 and verse 7. And by the way, if you think I'm skipping or hiding any verses that might contain the main point of the whole section, so scream it out. Don't be bashful. Chapter 22, verses 6 and 7. So this is about Balak, the king, in Mesopotamia, sending messengers to bring the sorcerer Bilam to his country. No, I'm sorry, I didn't say it properly. The king of Moab, where the Israelites are encamped, is Balak. And he's sending to Mesopotamia to bring Bilam to him to have him curse the Israelites. And he says in verse 6, come then, put a curse upon this people for me, since they are too numerous for me. Perhaps I can thus defeat them and drive them out of the land. For I know that he whom you bless is blessed indeed, and he whom you curse is cursed. Let's look at now the same chapter, 22, verse 12. When the messengers come, what Balak says is, I'll ask God if I can go with you. He asks God, and God says in verse 12, but God said to Bilam, do not go with them, you must not curse that people, for they are blessed. Right? All this is a review from last time. And then the same chapter, verse 18, we're just skipping four or so verses, five verses. Balak sends other dignitaries, another set of messengers, and they ask him again to come. And he says this time, in verse 18, Balak replied to Balak's officials, though Balak were to give me his full house of silver and gold, I could not do anything, big or little, contrary to the command of the Lord my God. I just do what God says. And then there's verse 20. That night God came to Bilam and said to him, if these men have come to invite you, you may go with them, but whatever I command you, that you shall do. There's also verse 35 in the same chapter. And verse 35 says, and this is when he's gone already, and the angel gets angry at him for going, and stands in the way to prevent him from going forward. But the angel of the Lord, in verse 35, said to Bilam, go with the men, but you must not say anything except what I tell you. Okay? And then the next chapter, I'm sorry, it's still the same chapter, verse 38. So he gets there, and he meets up with the king, Balak. But Balaam said to Balak, and now that I have come to you, have I the power to speak freely? I can only utter the word that God puts into my mouth. Now let's go to the next chapter, 23, verses 7 to 10. And this is his first prophecy when he sees the Israelites. And he says in verse 7 to 10, he took up his theme and said, "From Aram has Balak brought me, Moab's king from the hills of the east. Come, curse me, Jacob. Come, tell Israel's doom. How can I damn whom God has not damned? How doom when the Lord is not doomed? As I see them from the mountaintops, gaze on them from the heights, there is a people that dwells apart, not reckoned among the nations. Who can count the dust of Yaakov? Number the dust cloud of Israel. May I die the death of the upright. May my fate be like theirs, blessed like them." Beautiful prophecy. Let's look now at verse 12 in the same chapter. So of course the king complained, "How can you bless them? I said you should curse them." And in verse 12 he replied, "I can only repeat faithfully what the Lord puts in my mouth." That's it. Now verse 18 to 23 in the same chapter. His second prophecy. And he took up his theme and said, he's seeing now the Israelites camp below him in the valley. "Up, Balak, attend. Give ear unto me, son of Zippor. God is not a man to be capricious or mortal to change his mind. Would he speak and not act, promise and not fulfill? My message was to bless. When he blesses, I cannot reverse it. No harm is in sight for Jacob, no woe is in view for Israel. The Lord their God is with them, and their king's acclaim in their midst. God who freed them from Egypt is for them like the horns of the wild ox," etc., etc., etc. Let's read a little bit on. "Lo, there is no augury in Jacob, no divining in Israel." I'll stop there. Just a little bit more. 26, verse 26 in the same chapter. So he blesses when he's supposed to curse. And then the king gets angry, of course. And Bilam said to Balak in verse 26, "But I told you, whatever the Lord says, that I must do." Okay? Let's look at a little bit the next chapter, chapter 24 from the beginning. Now Bilam, seeing that it pleased God to bless Israel, did not, as on previous occasions, go in search of omens, but turned his face towards the wilderness. As Bilam looked up and saw Israel encamped tribe by tribe, the Spirit of God came upon him. Taking up his theme, he said, "Word of Bilam, son of Beor, word of the man whose eye is true, word of him who hears God's speech, who beholds visions from the Almighty, prostrate but with eyes unveiled. How fair are your tents, O Jacob, your dwellings, O Israel, like palm groves that stretch out, like gardens beside a river, like aloes planted by the Lord, like cedars besides the water," etc. One last verse before we put this aside and start thinking about the big picture. Verse 12 of the same chapter. Bilam replied to Balak, "But I even told the messengers you sent to me. Though Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I could not, of my own accord, do anything good or bad contrary to the Lord's command. What the Lord says, that I must say." He's repeated this like 10 times already. That's getting pretty boring. Okay. So that's the story in a nutshell. If something's repeated again and again and again, it's probably the main point. So the main point is something about the fact that the Jewish people are blessed and they can't be cursed, something like that. But if you think about it deeper, there's really two different ways of looking at the whole story. And I listed them on the sheet here. Let's think about this. So look in A2. I'm going to read what I wrote. God has blessed Israel. By the way, don't try not to read on. Just read what I'm reading. Let's do a little exercise here. Like, cover it up. God has blessed Israel, and no curses, augury, or sorcery could affect them. Bilam the sorcerer is powerless, no better than a donkey. God's blessings, should be with an S at the end, cannot be undone by curses, augury, or sorcery. God is supremely powerful, whereas curses and magic are powerless. If you don't look on, I don't know if you looked on, does that seem good to you? Does that seem like a good way to summarize the message? Right? God's in charge. These curses and magic are powerless. Bilam is just like a talking donkey, really can't do anything that's meaningful. God's a source of blessings. It seems like that's what it's saying, right? And that's beautiful, right? Mm-hmm. Telling us that God's in charge. No sorcery, no magic, nor the people can come close to God's power. If the Jewish people are blessed, they're blessed. Yeah. Except that there's a completely different way of understanding it. And when we look at the completely different way, that also might be convincing in the verses. So now look at the second way I phrased something, and it's just the opposite. I'll read it slowly. God will not allow Balaam to curse Israel. And Balaam is obedient to God's will. That makes sense, right? God puts a blessing in Balaam's mouth whenever he comes to curse Israel. That makes sense. But that implies that were God not to intervene to prevent the curse, it may have had an effect. Balaam's curses could have power. There's a world of black magic that may be at odds with God's rule of the universe. Do you see the difference between the two ways of phrasing the matter? They're opposites. But what's really the point? Is the point that curses have no power? Or is the point that curses have 100% power and therefore God prevents him from cursing? And you start to think about it, it's actually not clear. What's really the point? But just to make sure, Morris, we're about to say something. I see your mouth opened.
Let me give you another thought.
Okay.
Had God not intervened, because acting out of his own soul, would have gotten all that gold and silver. God was not nowhere in the picture. He would have become a rich man, and power of suggestion, placebo effect. Here's what I mean. If people think this guy has so much power and could curse Israel, then Balak and their people could believe it and believe they're empowered and could curse Israel and could attack Israel and win Israel. So I see him as a prophet. I don't see him as that. I see that God's purpose. I don't think he's as dumb as a donkey. I think he's acting, he has a conscience, and I don't think he's immortal. I think he's higher than that. So, I took it. I was not thinking that God is so great. Let me put it differently. I'm not phrasing that right. It wasn't that I took away that God is so great and he intervened. I'm saying that had God not intervened, he would have gone the selfish way. Just like Adam, mm-hmm. or just like Eve, when she pulled the original sin. That's the way I read it.
I would like to connect what you said to one of these two ways of looking at it. I think that what you just said does actually fit into one of the two ways. So this man wants to and is being paid to curse the Jewish people. And then the question, like Morris says, why does God intervene? Why doesn't God just let it happen? According to the second way of looking at it, B, God doesn't let it happen, because if it happens, that's dangerous for the Jewish people in a real sense. In a real sense.
What do you mean?
In a real sense that they'll be cursed and it'll cause them to be cursed. Bad things will happen to them because they're being cursed. Whereas Morris said, no, God intervenes not because they'll really be cursed and that curse will undo God's blessing and then the Jewish people will be defeated because they'll have demons attached to them or a curse attached to them or something intrinsically bad. Might remind you of our class on Wednesday mornings about the Rambam. Mm-hmm. Or, Morris says, no, nothing. They wouldn't become cursed. It wouldn't have any effect on them, essentially. But God's afraid of the placebo effect. God's afraid that it might have a psychological effect on the Midianites and on the Moabites. And it might help them, were they to hear that this man, Balaam, cursed the Jewish people, it might help them to be encouraged to go to war and do serious damage.
I wouldn't say God is afraid, I just said it wasn't.
Okay. But as far as the big question, and what is the message here? The message, you agree, is that these curses don't have any real effect. they are perhaps dangerous for psychosocial reasons, but they don't have any real effect in essentially changing the reality.
But if God has the ability to intervene to prevent that, then couldn't God also intervene to affect their perception that the curses were really happening?
There's a general rule that God doesn't interfere with human psychology. Okay. And the only place there's an exception to that is that God doesn't tamper with human free will and human perception, except in one case, the hardening of
Pharaoh's heart.
And that's why the Rambam finds it so difficult there. But besides that, we have a general principle, because without the general principle, so many stories just don't make any sense if God had the willingness to use such a power.
So we can't assume that he interfered here then?
Interfered in the psychology of the people. He interfered only in what it says he interfered. He told them not to curse, and Bilam agreed not to curse because God told him not to curse.
He was God-fearing.
He apparently was God-fearing to a certain degree, right?
Now, when they say curse, the curse was like made on behalf of who, or who was the entity that would curse?
That's a very good question. Perhaps there is no entity. Perhaps there was a belief that this man, Bilam, has power to curse. And if he says you're cursed, then you're cursed.
But what is curse?
Right, what does it mean?
Yeah, what does it mean? Like, I understand the blessing, and the blessing comes from the Lord, but the curse does not come from the Lord. It would be like sort of a consequence, but...
I understand. That's why I wrote in the sheet, black magic.
Like a sorcerer or something.
A sorcerer. Some other power.
See, I take it that it requires... That's sort of like, so the curse, or what? I mean, what I'm saying is what actually...
Well, I mean, would they have invaded the Israelites? Would they have...
They would have immediately been successful because this people is cursed.
So they're giving power to this other thing, backing up the curse.
Right. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of strange to you guys, but I want to kind of pound it into you. Not that I want you to believe it, but I want you to see that it's a possible way of reading the verses. Because you could say... Morris was very good in what he said, but putting aside what Morris said, you can say, look, this guy wants to go to curse the Jewish people. Now, we look at it and say, so what? Curse us. Stick, like you just said, sticks and stones can break my bones, but words can't harm me, so go curse me. So why does God get so wrought up over this guy who wants to curse the Jewish people? Let him curse. Big deal. Nothing's going to happen. Let him curse. But God goes through such an effort to prevent him from going, stay home, then the angel standing in the way of the donkey. And then when he finally gets there, God won't let him curse, but God forces him, not by getting into a psyche, but forces him by telling him, you can't curse, you just can't curse. And he understands that he can't curse. He has to bless. But it looks like the words are really important. The words he's going to say are important. And had he cursed, that would be bad news. Something would have happened in reality. There would be some black magic here. There would be a spell on the Jewish people. We have to avoid that at all costs, that spell. That's a possible way of reading it. It's actually a good way of reading it.
But doesn't it also say, though, that if he successfully curses them, then the enemy is going to attack because they're going to feel that the Jewish people are weakened?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So... the fact that God is stopping the curse is actually sparing blood. You know, it's helping to avoid bloodshed.
Oh.
And the fact, and I like your idea about the whole notion of the power of suggestion, because I think God also knows that the people of Israel are weak, so that even though they know that God has blessed them and that those who curse them will be cursed, God, they don't have that total faith that that will prevail, and they will therefore weaken at the threat of an oncoming army, and it won't bode well.
Yeah, that's certainly possible. I like that, but I also want us to know that it's possible to read it differently.
I was going to go on the piggyback tailing with death. Doesn't it say that death and life are on your tongue? If the Jewish people would have heard this curse, somehow they would have believed it and then start repeating it again. You know, and you know, as often as you repeat a lie, it becomes a truth. So they would be defeated in their eyes, taking their side of God and put it into this other curse.
I hear, and that makes sense. But I just want to say before Rhonda, so that's the question. It looks like we're saying the following. I didn't know it would go in this direction, but this is interesting. What we're saying is the following, that it's clear from the parsha that the curse could have an effect. But is the curse metaphysical in its effect, or is it psychosocial? That's really, you guys are saying it's psychosocial.
But your words become your thought. I mean, your thoughts become your words, and your words become your actions.
Mm-hmm. But that's still psychosocial. It's not okay. Metaphysical. It's like not metaphysical, I mean black magic.
Yeah.
So Rhonda wanted to speak.
I was just going to take it a step further and say that if Balak believes that the curse will be powerful, then having Balaam deliver the blessing repeatedly actually works on Balak by saying, no curse, blessing, 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 don't attack them.
Right.
Kind of.
Yeah.
More social.
There are two other, I want to give a completely different thought on this.
Okay.
So I could think of more about it. What we've been reading is, so far, has been focused on the Israelite people.
Just going to take notes while you're talking, because I like this.
No, it's all been focused on the Israelite people. And so all of a sudden we get this story. This is the first time, I think, one of the first times where we don't view an Israelite. We have some outside.
Right.
And just a thought came to my head. God sees all. And the Israelite people don't see all. God is in this role as a protector. And why are we having this story here now? And again, I'm just... One of the themes that we've been seeing with the Israelite people is they fear. They fear their enemies. We've heard plenty of stories about God has punished when they... I forgot all the stories we've read. It sort of run together. They sent the spies and then they were punished because they didn't follow God's law. So the first time God is almost, for lack of a better word, a father figure overlooking his people, that's saying, look, if I had a map, I'd say, look, here are the Israelites here. God's over here looking at Balak and saying, you know what, I'm going to be a protector. And I'm going to protect you from these people. Now, it's strange that he hasn't done that in the past, but it's almost like the eyes of God are looking at this area, and the Israelite people are looking way over here. That's what it feels like when I was reading this. Mm-hmm. I felt like I was off the reservation, you know?
Right.
And so it gave me I felt like I was in a different world. That's what it felt like when I was reading this story. I didn't feel like I was, I don't know, I felt like I was in a different country, a different frame of mind.
100%.
And that's what really struck me more about this story than anything else, is I physically felt, not physically, but... I was watching a movie, and all of a sudden they went to the scene, and the scene's way over here, and I'm like, how do we? And the main story is way over there, but it looked like God could see all. That's my point.
100%. That's really true. This is sui generis. This is unique.
Yeah.
And it had nothing to do with the Jewish people. Because if we assume the curses don't have any effect, so let them curse, what do we care? There's a lot of things happening out there in Moab and Midian that don't affect us. This also doesn't affect us. Why is it written here? It's written here, obviously, to teach a message, but now the question is, what's the message?
Mm-hmm. Well, that was one of the messages
I took. No, but you didn't say a message. You just said it's really a different frame of reference. But
it also shows that God sees all. He sees
that God sees all.
Knows all, sees all.
And protects, you said.
And in this role, it seems like he was...
Protects. Protects. Why do we need God's protection if the curses don't have any effect? Why is this called...
Because, like someone said, the curse could have snowballed to action, which could...
Okay, right. I understand. Okay, so we have to add that psychosocial or a metaphysical element into it to understand what's going on.
Right.
So, the reason I brought this up is because the Jewish people have actually debated this question, it looks like, for over 2,000 years. It's amazing how serious the commentators take this question. And it ends up being a raging, raging disagreement between two different camps in the Jewish people. The camp of the rationalists and the camp of the mystics. Again, it's going back to things we're studying Wednesday morning. And you can see this disagreement in many, many verses of the Torah where these two camps disagree. But here, it's so blatant. It's blatant not in the sense that we can actually see the commentators talking about these verses. They do. But just in the sense that once you start thinking about it, there really are two different ways of looking at it, and this will connect to things the commentators say in many, many other places. So I want to see some of these sources. I don't know how much we'll have time for. There's a lot of material I brought. Whatever we have time for, we'll do. So we're going to look at the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 18. That's really the locus of the discussion in the commentators, although it's found in other places as well. So Deuteronomy 18. Verses 9 to 15. Deuteronomy 18, 9 to 15. Here we go. When you enter the land that the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not learn to imitate the abhorrent practices of those nations. The word abhorrent in Hebrew is toivah, abomination. Let no one be found among you who consigns his son or daughter to the fire, or who is an augur, a soothsayer, a diviner, a sorcerer, one who casts spells, or one who consults ghosts or familiar spirits, or one who inquires of the dead. For anyone who does such things is abhorrent to the Lord, and it is because of these abhorrent things that the Lord your God is dispossessing them before you. That's what the Canaanites did. You must be wholehearted, the word is tamim, perfect, wholehearted, with the Lord your God. Those nations that you are about to dispossess do indeed resort to soothsayers and augurs to you, however, the Lord your God is not assigned the like. The Lord your God will raise up a prophet from among your own people, like myself, says Moses, him you shall heed, etc. So I want to just define what all these magical professions are, if anyone's looking for a job. So on the sheet, we're in B1, I talked about the augur. Looks like I spelled him wrong. I should have put a U in there. And that's in Hebrew, kosem samim. And that's a general term for diviner or fortune teller. Now let's just note, a diviner or fortune teller, they're people who, tautology, they see the future. It's nothing about changing reality, it's just knowing reality. Or they can also see, for example, there's a story about finding lost donkeys later on in the Tanakh. Seeing the present that other people can't see, to tell you where your lost objects are. The soothsayer is the mi'unen, and although it's not clear what it means, one of the commentators says that the word mi'unen comes from the language of anan, clouds, looks at the clouds to tell patterns of the future, looks at the cloud formations, again, about the future. The diviner is the menachesh, and if you remember, Yosef, when he acted as if his goblet was stolen, he had planted it in his brother's knapsack, and then the police caught the boys and brought them back. He said, didn't you know I divined in that goblet and I'd noticed it was missing? What is divining? So divining is when liquids of different, what's the word? Different densities are put in the goblet, and like you put oil in the water and the oil forms droplets, so you can tell the future, as it were, supposedly, on the basis of what droplets, what patterns the droplets form. That's divining. Then there's the sorcerer. That's a person who practices magic. It says in Exodus that such a person must be put to death. Magic here means changing reality, like pulling a rabbit out of a hat, right? Mm-hmm. Or making things happen. Then there's the one who casts spells, chover, chaver. That's a snake charmer, who again could change the way the snakes behave. Instead of making them bite, he'll make them act nice. Then the rest of them consult ghosts or familiar spirits or inquire of the dead. That's all ways of knowing reality, knowing the future, knowing the present by asking the dead. Different methods of talking to the dead. The assumption being the dead know more than the living know, if only you can get it out of them. So what it means is that there is two different professions mentioned here. Fortune tellers on the one hand, and magicians on the other hand. In the beginning and the end, it talks about the fortune tellers, and in the middle, it talks about the magicians, who are the sorcerers, the castings of spells, and the casters of spells. It's two of them. Two are magicians, and the rest of them are fortune tellers. Okay. So, all these things are forbidden. The Canaanites did them, you'll be thrown out of the land if you do the same thing. And like I said, in the book of Exodus, it says that the Mechashef, the magician, the one that's called here the sorcerer, he's to be put to death. Now we'll ask the same question that we asked when we studied the whole portion of Bilam. Why are these things forbidden? Two possible answers. There's Kayla's answer and Morse's answer and mental block.
Jerry's
answer. Right? They're objectionable because of their psychosocial effect. Perhaps. Or my answer. They are objectionable because they change reality in a way that's against God's will. And of course, I'm talking specifically about the sorcerer and the caster of spells. They can manipulate reality. And God doesn't want his reality manipulated. When so it's forbidden.
When Saul goes to see that... Doesn't it mention that divinity... I forget the word. Is like a sin of rebellion?
Yes, it does. But what does that prove?
That rebellion will change the way things are.
There are many who agree with you. If I take the devil's advocate approach, I'll agree with you. In other words, we have the whole story in which Saul conjures up the dead Samuel. I think we read it a few weeks ago or something in this room. Did I bring it for some reason?
I wasn't here.
I don't remember. In a different class, perhaps.
That,
now we're here.
Say it again?
Carolyn,
now we're here.
It was here?
Yes.
Okay, so in some context we brought that.
Yes, we talked about it.
I don't remember what context, goodness gracious. So, anyway, Saul the king brings up Samuel the dead prophet and wants to talk to him. And it's very clear there that he's doing something that's forbidden by the Torah. But the question is, what's actually going on? It looks like he succeeded really in bringing up this dead man. It means that all these occult professions, it works, it's true. But it's forbidden.
And she was surprised when she saw Samuel. She was like, what?
Yeah, but she did, right? No, but the truth is there are some rationalists who say that it was all a fake, it was all a trick. It didn't really happen. Now, but the Tanakh does say it did happen. So the same question here. Are these practitioners legitimate? In a sense, does it work? And it's forbidden because God doesn't want them to be around. They change the way he set things in their course. Or are they forbidden for some other reason? Because of the psychosocial effect? Because they deflect people's attention from what's really true? So that's a big, big disagreement between the Ramban and the Rambam. Ramban is Nachmanides, one of those famous Jewish mystics, as opposed to the Rambam, the Maimonides, one of the most famous Jewish rationalists. How do we read those these verses? So we're going to look now at the Ramban, and I brought the English. This is the Ramban in his commentary on these verses. We don't have to read all of it because time is short. Look what the computer did. I don't know. It turned some sign. It turned my period to the end of a...
Oh, yeah.
Why did it do that?
Strange.
I'll tell you why. Because there's black magic in my computer.
That's hilarious.
There it is.
He's going to be asked... I'm going to burn him at the stake. So, let's read from the fourth paragraph. Now, know and understand the matter of sorcery. For God may be blessed when he created everything from nothing. He made the upper world sovereign over the lower worlds, which are beneath them. And he gave power over the earth and all that is upon it to the heavenly bodies and constellations. according to their rule and their spell in the lower world, as is shown in the science of astronomy, astrology. In medieval times, they didn't always distinguish between astronomy and astrology. Now, what word is missing? I guess no word. However, in God's great wondrousness, he created ways for the forces to be influenced. In other words, there's a certain natural pattern that's created, that things are supposed to happen, and they're influenced by the constellations, whether you call it astronomy, like the tides, or call it astrology, like the astrological signs. There's influence. But God has created ways for the forces to be influenced. However, the normal course of nature is the will of God, according to how he arranged the heavenly bodies from the very beginning. This is the secret of the workings of sorcery which oppose God's will. It is, our rabbis said about the sorcerers in Tractate Chulin, that they are in opposition to the heavenly retinue. In other words, they contradict the normal forces and in a certain sense oppose the retinue. Therefore, it is fitting that the Torah forbade these practices so that the world will be left to its natural course, which is the will of God, will of the Creator. There are ways you can manipulate, but God doesn't want you to manipulate. He wants things as he created them. Let me just see if there's anything else I want to read. Yeah. Todd, are you about to say something? No. Okay.
Well, he believes in fortune tellers and sorcery.
Both the fortune tellers and the sorcerers. Mm-hmm. Both of them. The Ramban is in Spain, and the year is about 1240, approximately. 1230, perhaps it's 1220, perhaps it's even 1245, I'm not sure, but
Holy
it's the first half of the 13th
time.
Century. Yes, sir?
Holy Inquisition time.
A little bit before. The Inquisition is, the Inquisition begins in 1290. And of course, really ratchets up in 1492.
Yeah.
The Rambam was a generation earlier. The Rambam died in 1204. So now, let's read the Ramban. So that Ramban was on, right, chapter 18, where we are, verse 9. And now the same Ramban on a few verses later, where it says, be wholehearted with God. Tamim, you should be perfect with God. Now, don't follow these sorcerers and fortune tellers. Rather, be wholehearted with God. It's on the same piece of paper. We're not even changing, not even moving. There's the Hebrew and then the English again, the bottom of the page. The meaning of wholehearted is that we are to direct our hearts to him only and believe that he alone does everything. It is he who knows the truth about all future events, and from him alone, from his prophets, are we to inquire of future events. Not from the fortune tellers, but from the prophets of God. If we hear any predictions of the diviners, we are to say, everything is in the hands of heaven, who is supreme above all, the Lord over all, who changes the will, the course of the stars and the constellations, who frustrates the omens of pretenders and makes the augurs go mad. And we must believe that all that occurs is a function of the degree to which one comes close to God's service. Therefore, after the warning about inquiring about future events from the diviners, it states that you are to be wholehearted with God in all these matters and not be overawed by those who tell you of things to come. Rather, you should inquire of his prophet, and to him you shall hearken. You know, don't listen to these other things. Don't pay attention to them. They do have power, but you should still not pay attention. Just accept the way God has ordered things. That's what it means to be wholehearted. Not to follow the sorcerers and the fortune tellers, not to look for ways to manipulate reality, even though they work. But just accept the way God has ordained things. Again, even though it is possible to change things, but don't. To be tamim, to be, means in a certain sense, to be wholehearted means to be, in a certain sense, passive, accepting. For the Ramban.
I guess we agree with him these days, because I don't think too many people believe in sorcery or magic. Some people do believe.
But he does believe in them. He does believe in them.
Oh yeah,
right?
No, but I'm. Oh yeah.
Right.
I guess so. Yeah.
The question is, why do you refrain? Because it works, but you're forbidden to get involved, or because it doesn't work?
Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Right. Let's see the next source that I brought. And this is the Ramban again. In general, then, when Israel is in perfect accord with God, constituting a large number, their affairs are not conducted at all by the natural order of things, neither in connection with themselves nor with reference to the land, neither collectively nor individually, for God blesses their bread and their water and removes sickness from their midst, so that they do not need a physician and do not have to observe any of the rules of medicine. Just as he said, "For I, the Eternal, thou healeth thee. And so did the righteous ones act at the time when prophecy existed, so that even if a mishap of iniquity overtook them, causing them sickness, they did not turn to the physicians, but only to the prophets, as was the case with Hezekiah when he was sick, in the book of Kings. And scripture says of Asa, king of Judah, by way of rebuke, yet in his disease he sought not to the Eternal, but to the physicians." And that's a negative statement about him. Now, had the practice of consulting physicians been customary among them, why should the verse mention a sinful act, as is consulting the physician, since his guilt was only because he did not also seek God? But the verse can be compared to someone saying, "That person did not eat unleavened bread on the festival of Passover, instead ate leavened bread. For he who seeks the Eternal through a prophet will not consult the physicians. And what part do the physicians have in the house of those who do the will of God, after he has assured us, 'And he will bless thy bread and thy water, and will take sickness away from the midst of thee'?" In other words, you shouldn't consult doctors, but go to the prophet. "Whereas the physicians are mostly concerned with food and drink, warning the patient against eating certain foods and commanding them to eat others. Thus also the rabbi said, during all the 22 years that Rabbah reigned as the head of the academy in Pombedita," that's in the Talmud, "Rav Yosef did not call even a blood letter to his house." The blood letter was the equivalent of a doctor for them. "As he, being a righteous person, was protected directly by God and needed no physicians. And they also said, by way of a proverb, 'A gate which is not open to the commandments is open to the physician.'" You don't do the commandments, then you need a doctor. But do the commandments, you don't need a doctor, says the Ramban. This is also the meaning of the saying, "People should not have to take medicines, but they have become accustomed to do so." We got used to going to doctors, so we go. That is to say, had they not accustomed themselves to taking medicines, people would become sick according to the degree of punishment corresponding to their sin, would be healed by the will of God. But since they accustom themselves to medications, God has left them to natural happenings. This is also the intent of the rabbi's interpretation. "And he shall cause thee to be thoroughly healed." That's in the context of the laws of damages in the book of Exodus. And it says that if you hit someone and he has to go to the doctor, then you have to pay for him to be thoroughly healed. You have to pay the doctor's bills. So you see the Torah condones going to doctors. Mm-hmm. "No, says the Ramban, from here you deduce the principle that permission has been given to the physician to heal." That's a quote from the Talmud. "They did not say that permission was given to the sick to be healed by the physician, but instead they stated that since the person who became sick comes to the physician to be healed because he's accustomed himself to seeking medical help and he was not of the congregation of the Eternal whose portion is in his life, the physician should not refrain from healing him." In other words, physician, if someone comes to him, has permission to heal, but it's not a good thing. He really shouldn't be doing such things. Healing people and giving out medicine, doing surgery and radiation therapy and chemotherapy. Shouldn't be doing that. But since people are asking him and we've got used to it, we allow it.
He's really off base here.
He was in the 12th century.
I understand. But I want you to know about it.
Can I ask a question about the very first sentence?
The very first sentence, of course.
"In general, then, when Israel is in perfect accord with God, constituting a large number..."
And I'm not sure exactly.
That sounds messianic to me. I mean, that doesn't sound like... I mean, does the Ramban believe... Believe that Israel is in perfect order according to God at this time?
During the time that he's of the prophets, not his time, during the time of the prophets,
okay,
when they were all of them in a large number in the land of Israel,
okay,
he believes that the righteous didn't go to doctors.
Okay.
They just relied on God,
okay,
on their righteousness.
Alrighty.
I'm going to read the last seven or eight lines. because he says that it's God alone who is the healer of all flesh, since after all people have already accustomed themselves to seeking such help. Therefore, when men contend and one smites the other with a stone or a fist, the one who smote must pay for the healing, for the Torah does not base its laws upon miracles. Just as it says, for the poor shall never cease out of the land, knowing before that such will be the case. But when a man's ways please the Eternal, he need have no concern with physicians. What I want to do now...
I mean, this is dangerous stuff if anybody really believes this.
The Ramban doesn't agree with you.
I'm just saying.
Can you say that louder?
I said you should talk to some Jehovah's
Witness. Or the
Christian
blood
Science.
Not Jehovah's Witness, but the...
Christian Scientists.
Christian Scientists. Mary Baker Eddy. They're the ones that don't go to doctors.
Yeah, but wasn't... I mean, he's talking about medicine that was like sorcery. It wasn't...
Based on a scientific method.
But there were doctors who did prescribe certain foods and
rest. Who was a doctor,
rest.
Ramban or Ramban?
The Ramban was a doctor. Yes, this is a doctor talking. But he sees the practice of medicine as a fall. It shouldn't be that. We've gotten accustomed to it. We're living in exile. We're away from God. That's the way it is. But it's not the ideal. Now, what I want to do... now is explain the connection between everything we've just seen, because this is really important. We began talking about the parsha of Bilam the Balak, and we said there were two ways of learning it, and it might be telling us, theoretically it might be telling us, that God intervened to prevent Bilam from cursing the Jewish people, teaching you that curses have power. And we saw then in Deuteronomy that the Ramban said that sorcerers have power. It's true, it works. It's metaphysical, it's black magic. It has an effect on reality in the most direct sense. And then the Ramban said, if it has reality, if it's true, if it works, why does the Torah forbid it? Because God wants things to work as He set them. He doesn't want us interfering, but the interference works, but you're not allowed to do it. And then the Ramban we saw explains, what does it mean to be wholehearted with God? It means to accept things as they are, not to interfere with the use of this black magic. I want to show the connection between all that, on the one hand, and what we just saw in the Ramban on the other hand. The Ramban here is not talking about black magic, he's talking about medicine. But just like he believes, you're not supposed to have recourse to black magic even though it works. He says you're not also to have recourse to medicine even though it works. It's the same philosophy in both cases. The philosophy is that God has set the universe in a certain fashion, and there are ways to manipulate it, but you're not allowed. You're supposed to accept the thing, the situation as it is. And if you're good, you won't get sick. And if you're bad, you'll get sick.
Hate that.
And if you do get sick, don't go to the doctor, but repent. And if you do go to the doctor, there's something wrong with your faith. Okay, so the Ramban says in his time, everyone does it, so we do it, but in ideal situations, no. So the big point here is that there's really, it doesn't matter whether it's black magic or white magic. White magic, I mean medicine. They work. It works. It's good. Doctors know what they're doing, and witch doctors know what they're doing. But you're supposed to depend not on witch doctors and not on physicians, but rather on, to use the words of Deuteronomy, on the prophet, which means God. And any intervention, whether at Medical City or at the astrologer's store, is going against, in theory, going against the will of God, which is for you to accept the way He set down the course of things.
Okay,
that's good. So what does it say about God and our relationship to God, according to the Ramban?
Yeah, that's my question.
So the answer is the Ramban's explanation of that commandment, be wholehearted. It means be accepting.
Submit to God's will.
Mm-hmm. Accepting of God's will, yeah.
But that flies in the face of what God put on the
table. Right, that flies in the face. This whole thing flies in the face of many things that we've been taught.
Science.
Right. And the importance of harnessing science. Because you guys have all been taught a rationalistic approach to Judaism. Now, I don't... I'm not against that. I'm a rationalist myself. But I think it's important to see that the Torah could be interpreted in this mystical fashion. And one of the greatest rabbis that ever lived went in that direction. And someone asked earlier, when did the Ramban live? Right? And I said, the Middle Ages. And you kind of thought to yourselves, well, that's the Middle Ages. But I want you to know that this has been the majority approach, the mainline approach in Judaism for a long time.
I'm having trouble understanding.
Until this very day. Until this very day. Yeah.
Well, I just want
to... We have to get to the rational approach before we leave, by the
okay.
way. But enough of this, please.
I just want to comment again that I feel like in a perfect world, I can be accepting of this, but I feel like when Adam and Eve sinned, we're no longer in a perfect world, nor will we ever be. But
yeah,
Ramban is saying there were times when the Jewish people were perfectly wholeheartedly, just not in his time. Okay.
Although still after the fall.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. But see, you can understand where this is coming from, where other people just can't get their minds around it. It's just too foreign, right?
Yeah, seems weird.
No, but I think you're able to put yourself in the Ramban's place, whereas Morris and Carol Ann are... This is,
You know, my mother-in-law would say, I've heard her, may she rest in peace, would say things like, I just don't know what I did to deserve this, you know, talking about something. And, you know, like, what did I do bad to deserve this? And I just used to make me so upset because she didn't do anything.
Right, right.
You know, to deserve any punishment or something.
What is Ramban's view of God? What I'm trying to understand is what is he trying to say about his comment and the relationship?
And when I say passivity and acceptance, that doesn't hone in on what you're asking?
Acceptance, I guess this is...
Accept God's will. Don't try and fight it.
That is so contrary to what I've grown up to believe and understand the Jew does. We
right.
argue, we question.
Right.
Even if it's questioning God's words.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And quite honestly, I've always considered the Christian perspective more of passivity and acceptance mm-hmm. and blind faith and mm-hmm. trust without... question.
I understand. I really understand.
This God also, to me, seems to be more about the big picture that you were talking about. I mean, my little piece of it is not to be messed with because there's a big picture.
I keep coming back to Job. I don't know why. I keep thinking about Job. Mm-hmm. There are things we just don't understand. There are, mm-hmm. you can be a perfect person and things still don't meet God's will. And then I really get philosophical. How do we know what God's will is? I mean, mm-hmm. I don't want to continue to question, but mm-hmm. I think rationality, it's how it's almost ingrained in our culture. Mm-hmm. The wonderful things, I think, are there for human beings
right.
to use.
Right, I understand. It really looks like with this type of worldview, science would not have been born.
Mm-hmm. And that sort of begs the question, when do you think God would want us to use the tools that we have in order to...
Well, maybe it's not making it better.
Or not better. It works both, yeah. cuts both yeah. ways. I'm saying right. science is, can be used for...
The Ramban would say, you want to make the world better? Do the commandments, and you'll be healthy, and the world will be better.
You'll get right with God.
Then you'll get it right.
As a Christian said, get right with God.
Yeah, get right.
Whereas what we're doing now, would say the Ramban, we are going against the will of God. Again, the Ramban really wouldn't say this because he accepts it already. But in theory, he would say that what we're doing is going against the will of God. We're manipulating, taking things into our own hands. And ultimately, that's not for the better because we're losing sight of the fact that what really matters is our own behavior, morally, ethically, religiously. That's what the Ramban would say.
Okay, that's helpful.
Right? And it's not just the Ramban. We won't see the sources here. We have Rabbi Dolevi. who holds the same thing, the Kuzari, who comes before the Ramban. And this idea we find in Judaism to this very day. And it's not rare. You might even say it's the mainstream. I understand that in America, in the past century, it hasn't been emphasized because it's so much counter to the culture that you just throw the rabbi out of the street and not renew his contract. Right? If he were to teach you this. But it's pretty mainstream.
But it makes sense because all the advances in technology and all the advances, the will of God, because he says that he has plans for us to prosper us and to give us hope in the future. But it guides us to these other things, to rely on them and to make them our God.
I don't know. I work. I can't get away from it. I don't mean to get too personal, but I mean, it's hard.
No, we want to get personal.
It's hard to say just leave it up to God when you have... You're trying to figure out how 2, 3, 4, 5 year olds die of cancer.
Yeah.
I used to deal with it all the time. I mean, it tests
your faith.
It's not just beyond test my faith. I mean, you want to do something about it. You want to help people. You want to.
But the Ramban would answer you: do something, pray.
Pray.
Do something, give charity. Do something, be a better Jew and a better human being. That's what he would say. At least theoretically. Again, he's already accepted there's been a fall. I don't want to take this too far. But the Ramban doesn't go about criticizing people who go to doctors, practically speaking. He's criticizing it in a theoretical sense. But the philosophy, the theology lives. So that's really important, I think, to grapple with. And like, you know, like Kayla helped us to grapple with it, and Rhonda, we do have to understand that it does make a degree of sense. And there really is, like we said earlier with Morris, there is, you could see something wrong with our modern world in relying on ourselves. And really, I've heard it said more than once that the world has advanced quite a bit in the last 200 years, but it's on the level of science has advanced. Has it advanced morally? Has it? Right? And the opposite is the case. We've used science for the most immoral usages that are possible. So that's the Ramban. Again, he has a foundation in the book of Deuteronomy and in our parsha that we're learning today, the parsha of Bilam and Balak. But there's a whole different way of looking at it, which is the Ramban, Maimonides, who really reads everything differently. So let's look at the Ramban. And the place we're looking at is on the third sheet of paper. Or is it the fourth? It's the fourth sheet of paper. A dotted line at the end of the first third of the page. And then the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, Laws of Idolatry, Chapter 11. How is necromancy practiced? And he goes and explains what it is. It's forbidden to consult a ghost or a familiar spirit, and he goes and talks about that. When it performs sorcery, he talks about that. And then in Halakha 16, all these matters, meaning both sorcery and necromancy, both fortune-telling and magic, are all matters of falsehood and deceit. And it was with these that the early idolaters made the other non-idolatrous Gentiles deviate and follow them. It is not fitting for Jews who are intelligent and wise to use such nonsense. We are meant to think that they are of any use, for it's written, surely there's no enchantment in Jacob nor divination in Israel. That's a verse from our parsha we're learning today, right? That's what Bilam said. The stuff just doesn't work. It's nonsense. It's ridiculous. And it is also written, for these nations that you are to dispossess, hearken to diviners and augurs, but as for you, the Lord your God has not allowed you to do so. That's a verse from Deuteronomy 18, which the Ramban will say it means it works, but you're not allowed. But for the Rambam, the verse says you can't do it, and that proves it doesn't work, because why would God forbid you to do something that works? That's the Rambam's logic. Anyone who believes in these or similar things and imagines in his heart that they are true and a branch of wisdom, but that we don't practice them because the Torah forbade them, anyone who believes that is nothing but a fool who is lacking knowledge, and in the category of women and children, excuse me, who are of undeveloped intelligence.
He was in the 12th century.
But by the way, I'll just say parenthetically, the truth is the Rambam was very, very advanced in his approach to women. because he always says that women are of undeveloped intelligence. Not that they don't have intelligence, but it hasn't been developed because of education. He always makes a point of saying that. But it's a whole different can of kosher worms. However, these people who are wise, those people who are wise and of a perfected intelligence know, on the basis of clear proofs, that all these things the Torah forbade are not a branch of wisdom, but are merely nonsense and vanity, which those lacking in knowledge follow, and because of which abandon the ways of truth. Because of these, when warning us against these vanities, the Torah says, you shall be perfect, the Lord your God. That's the verse that says, be wholehearted. So, we have to look now, not at one point, but at two. The point that's right before our eyes is that the Ramban and the mystics say these things work. And the Rambam and the rationals say they don't work. Yeah, that's important. But there's a second point, which is the matter of how we interpret this verse, you shall be wholehearted with the Lord your God, you shall be perfect. For the Ramban, it means be passive and accept. God's way is as it is. Don't get involved in trying to manipulate things, even though manipulations could work. But your place is to accept. Whereas for the Rambam, when it says you shall be perfect with the Lord your God, it means don't follow after Narishkeit. That's what it means. In other words, it means don't waste your time. It's not be passive and don't get involved. It's don't waste your time with things that don't work. And for the Rambam, the corollary is do spend your time on things that do work. In other words, while the Ramban classifies black magic and white magic in the same category, it works, but it's interference with God's world, don't do it. The Rambam will divide between them. Do what works. Don't do what doesn't work.
I want to go back to kind of where you started, which is that the Bilam and Balak story, that the people of Israel are about to go into the land. And God is saying to them in Deuteronomy, when you get into the land, the people that you encounter there are going to be practicing all of these other things, and you're forbidden to do it. Isn't that also a way of telling them, you can't mix with these people, you can't become a part of them, you have to remain separate from them, and so that you maintain your integrity? And then taking it back even further to what you were saying earlier, that like this big metaphysical picture where they're here and they're here, it's almost like I picture the God's intervention in the story at that point as almost trying to purify the neighborhood before the people of Israel enter the land, saying, we're not going to have these auguries. We're not going to have all of this garbage going on here that'll muck up the atmosphere, because the people of Israel are about to go in and they're embarking on something very elevated.
Mm-hmm. 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 Good. That's very good. Yeah. Let's look at the Rambam's commentary on the Mishnah in Tractate Psachim. There's a Mishnah that says, six things were done by King Chizkiah. Everyone see the place? Three of them were accepted and three were not accepted. He banned the book of medical remedies and his decision was accepted. That's an ancient tradition. So here is Maimonides' commentary on the Mishnah. That's the Rambam. I have heard, and it has been explained to me as well, that King Solomon composed this book of medical remedies, that when a person would become sick or any malady would affect him, he would look it up in the book and would do as prescribed therein, and he would be healed. Now when Chizkiah took note that people were not relying on God, may he be blessed, he banned the book and took it out of circulation. That's what the Rambam heard people are saying. You certainly hear the problematics of this interpretation, its foolishness. How have they attributed to Chizkiah stupidity that one would not attribute to the worst of human beings? And they have done the same concerning his contemporaries who accepted his decision. According to their mistaken and unthought out notion, a hungry man who will go and eat from a loaf of bread, a loaf it should be, not load, loaf of bread and will certainly be healed from the serious sickness of hunger is to be considered as abandoning God and not relying on Him? No, we should call such people fools. Just like we thank God when we eat, for He's provided me that which satisfies me and removes my hunger so that I live and flourish, so should I thank God when He provides me with a medical remedy through which I can be healed of my disease. I would not have had to challenge such a faulty approach had it not been so prevalent. So the Rambam hasn't told us how he understands the Mishnah that says that there was this book of medical remedies that was banned. He didn't tell us how he understands it. But he does tell us that the interpretation he's heard is absolutely ridiculous. If there would be a book of medical remedies of things that worked, and it was banned because people were relying on the book and not on God, that's ridiculous, says the Rambam. And the Rambam is equating, if you notice, helping yourself and relying on God the same thing. When you help yourself, relying on God, because you're using what God gave you. And we work and we have food from the fields and we eat and we thank God. We did the work, we thank God, because it's the same thing, it's a partnership. God gave us the tools to help ourselves. It's the old story of the helicopter. You know the flood in the helicopter?
Oh, yeah.
Is it the joke? To make a long story short, oh, you know, yeah, this guy's in a flood, and the house, you know the whole,
no? Oh, yeah.
No.
Yeah.
You don't know the joke. Who wants to tell a joke? I won't tell a joke anyway. So he's in a flood, and the police come in a lifeboat to save him. He says, no, I'm waiting for God. And then the flood comes higher, he goes up to the first story, and they have to come and save him in a big boat. And they say, no, waiting for God. Then he goes up to the roof, because the flood is so high, and they come in a helicopter. He says, no, I'm waiting for God. And he drowns. So in heaven, he asks God, why didn't you save me? God said, I tried. I sent you a boat. I sent you a ship. I sent you a helicopter. You didn't want to. Yeah. So that's what the Rambam is saying. That Carol Ann likes.
Yeah, I like this.
Actually, there's a Czech proverb that says, do the best you can and God will prosper your efforts.
Huh?
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I brought lots of other sources, but we get the idea, I think. And actually, we've summarized pretty well. So what I want to do at the end is bring it back to the place we started, as you began to do. All this was to say that there are two different ways of reading our parsha. So I looked and tried to see if there's anything in the Ramban on our parsha that would be a hint to the whole worldview we've brought up. So I found something in the Ramban that I translated just 2 hours ago, and I have it in the very last sheet here, very last side. Commentary on the Ramban of the Ramban, Book of Numbers, chapter 22, verse 23. It's in the context of the talking donkey. The purpose of this miracle was to show Bilam who gave a mouth or who makes him dumb, to make it known to him that it is God who opens the mouth of the dumb, and that he may all the more so by his will make dumb the mouth of those who normally speak. For he will put in their mouth the speech that he so desires. And to warn him that he should not rely on divination and sorcery to curse them, for indeed he was a divine and sorcerer. So now we understand what the Ramban is saying, that he was a divine, he was a sorcerer, and it works. But God came to warn him, don't do it. Because I'll do to you what I just did to the donkey. I'll prevent you from speaking. Just like I open the donkey's mouth, I can close your mouth. That's what God did in the end. But it's now we understand that God's warning him because God knows that if he does manage to speak, he will curse and that will have an effect. That's the way the Ramban reads it. God has to come and prevent that man from cursing, because if he does, we're in trouble. Whereas there's no commentary of the Rambam on the Torah, but there is a commentary of the Ralbag. The Ralbag is Rabbi Levi ben Gershon, who was a medieval scientist living over 100 years after the Rambam, but he saw himself certainly as a follower of the Rambam, as a scientist rationalist. And the Ralbag's works were not available. His commentary on the Torah was not available until about 10 years ago when this was printed. Actually, they're still in the process of finishing the five books of the Torah. They did one of the five books haven't finished yet, putting this out. But since it's come out, I've tried to learn it because it's really fascinating. And it's not widely known because it really wasn't available widely until this decade. So look what the Ralbag says on chapter 22, verse 6. That's the very beginning of our parsha about Bilam and Balak. And he's talking now about Bilam. He says, he knew the future for each person by way of divination, to the should be greatest, to the greatest degree that one can know such things through divination. He was better at it than all the other diviners, and many things that he predicted indeed would come true. He was also a trickster, and when he knew through divination that something bad would occur to someone, he would curse that person. When he knew that something good would occur to someone, he would bless that person. And he would thereby cause people to believe that those who he blesses are blessed and those who he curses are cursed. So he takes a middle ground that the fortune-telling works, but the sorcery doesn't, which is really what's important to us, right? And he explains that he pulled the wool over people's eyes in sorcery through the use of divination. Pretty ingenious. And then the Ralbag a little bit later, there's a question to be asked. Why did God make such an effort to prevent Bilam from cursing the Israelites? Since God said they are blessed, what damage could be caused by Bilam's curse? That's our original question. Again, if you believe it works, then the question is not a question. If you believe it doesn't work, then the question is a question. It seems to me that we should say that God did this for the following reason. He says something very similar to what you guys said about the psychosocial effect of the curse. When they will sin and God will punish them to teach them a lesson, they would understand that their sin was the cause of the punishment that came upon them. So they'll repent and he'll have mercy upon them. But if Bilam had cursed them, if God had allowed it, they would have thought that the evil that came upon them was a result of Bilam's curse and not their own deeds. So again, he talks about their psychosocial realm and not the metaphysical realm. I have to admit, he then goes on to say, you know what, I'm not sure. And perhaps the Ramban is right. But he does bring us a exegetical defense of the Rambam, how to understand our verses. And again, it's very similar to the psychosocial effect that some of you mentioned earlier. So you can take your pick. But I really think it's important to be aware that this argument exists in the Jewish sources, and the Torah really does support both approaches. And it really may be true that the mystical approach has been the more accepted one over the course of Jewish history. In America today, clearly our whole orientation and our training is rational, and we certainly have a leg to stand on in the Rambam and the Ralbag. But you should know that certainly to this very day there are mystics, Jews who are mystics, and this is the foundation, this is related to the foundation of their worldview.
So, would a mystic say that there is evil in the world?
There are...
Or evil forces?
Yeah, there are forces that can be manipulated and used for evil. Absolutely. In Kabbalah, it's called the Sitra Achra, the other side. And there is certainly... beliefs in such things. And of course the Rambam would say that that actually is an affront to monotheism. But the Ramban would not say that. Again, if you believe in those other forces that God doesn't have full control over, the Ramban said that God created them, but once he created them, apparently he doesn't have full control over them. And the Kabbalah develops the idea of these satanic forces to a large degree.
And there's no, and I don't know if he, irony is it sounds almost scientific and mathematical. Motion, there's not much you
right.
can do about it.
Right.
You do it according to God's will, as opposed to rationalist that says, there is a rational deal with certain things.
Right.
As opposed to,
right. Absolutely.
It's just, it's not easy to think that way, but I guess that's my... I always like to come away from our classes with one or two takeaways. I'm struggling with this one tonight.
So the Ramban says you can affect reality, or the proper way to affect it is through your moral deeds, through your religious and moral deeds. Whereas in the Rambam, there's an emphasis on affecting reality through your natural deeds, your scientific deeds. Okay?
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
I'll see you in 2 weeks.
You're going to Israel.
Yeah.